Now, back to brainstorming with Billy.
A perfectly good brain wasted.
Now, here's your host, Billy the Brain.
Welcome back. This is Bill Frank, and you're listening to Brainstorming with Billy the Brain here on KKZZ, Positive Talk Radio for Ventura and Santa Barbara Counties. Every show has a theme, and today's theme is Thank God It's Monday. All of my guests are helping us to start off our week on the right foot. My first guest is a consultant, an author, a motivational speaker, and three-time Entrepreneur of the Year. She helps change workplace culture so that every employee is motivated to come to work. We discussed her latest book, Thank God It's Monday. My next guest has served the United States since the 1950s and the Eisenhower administration. He's been an advisor to presidents, and he's helped the United States transition power from Richard Nixon to Gerald Ford during one of the bleakest periods in American history. We'll discuss his recent memoir, Known and Unknown. If you want to join in the conversation or if you want to talk to Donald Rumsfeld, you can always call us at 639-0008. Donald Rumsfeld, as I said, has served this country since the 1950s. He was in military service back in the 50s, elected to Congress from Illinois, the city of Chicago, where he served there, and then went on to serve in the Richard Nixon White House as well. Most recently, people will remember him as the Secretary of Defense. Most people, however, will not remember that he is the second longest tenured Secretary of Defense, second only to Robert McNamara, who served in the Johnson and the Kennedy White Houses as well. Welcome to the show, Don. How are you today?
Just fine. Thank you very much.
Well, it's our great pleasure to have you here. And first of all, I would be remiss if I did not thank you for your years of service to the United States. I mean, your career has spanned 50 years. And while critics may look at one or two instances in your career and they draw conclusions or hurl stones, I like it that your book, Known and Unknown, your memoir, really covers your entire body of service to the country, and it provides a much more thoughtful look at your career rather than just isolated snapshots. So thank you for that.
Well, thank you very much. It's amazing when you think about it. At 78 years old, I've lived one-third of the history of our country.
Well, now that's a staggering thought. I had not thought of it in those terms. I was thinking more along the lines of you're now a New York Times best-selling author, in addition to being a two-time Secretary of Defense, a congressman, an advisor to presidents. I mean, you have had an accomplished life. But I want to dig right into the meat of this, if I can, Don. The first question I'd like to ask you involves the commitment to go to war in Iraq and Afghanistan, and that really starts off with the attacks on 9/11. So what I want you to help describe for my readers is what it's like to make significant decisions, such as going to war, when the information on which to base that decision is fragmented and it's incomplete.
Well, of course, the real decision maker is the President of the United States, and the rest of us are really advisors to him. And in the case of September 11th, the CIA, George Tenet, concluded rather quickly, even the same day, that Al-Qaeda was behind the attack on September 11th. And we had, of course, normally in the Pentagon, you'd have contingency plans for various things that are likely to happen. But there was no roadmap for going after Al-Qaeda. There was no guidebook. There was no previous experience of going after a terrorist network as such. And as a result, General Franks and his team had to develop a plan that would go after the Al-Qaeda and the Taliban in Afghanistan from scratch. And they did it, and they did a very good job.
And their hats off to them for the work that they did, both in preparing the military strategy behind that, but also executing on that military strategy. I guess then that there are two parts to this thought that I have. And the one part, of course, is the preparation that you've just addressed. The second part is more of how do you communicate such a complex idea to the American people? So let me take a step back and ask you, as a two-time Secretary of Defense, talk to us about the changing nature of war, because when you first took office, you know, we had just come off of Vietnam. It was very clear we had an enemy, we fought the enemy, and so forth. How is that different today, the nature of war, and how is that so much more difficult to communicate to the population of the United States?
Well, that's a terrific point to bring up and a question. The reality is, if you think about it, in World War I and World War II, we were against nation states. And it was a beginning and an ending that each was finite and discrete. In the case of a war against radical Islamists and extremists and terrorists, it's quite different. It's much more like the Cold War, where it's a competition of ideas. The Cold War didn't start and end at a finite time. It lasted for decades. And it was really the concept of a free political and a free economic system versus a communist system, a dictatorial system, and a command economy. And that lasted over you know, many decades. And what we're in today is more like that than it is like World War I or World War II. And that means you've got to be willing to engage and compete in the battle of ideas. You can go out and try to deter and defend. You can go out and try to capture and kill terrorists. And certainly the United States and a coalition of some 90 countries are doing that. But you also have to recognize that people are being recruited and trained and in these madrasa schools and taught how to strap on suicide bombs. And the question is, are you killing and capturing more than they're training? And that's really of a kind with the Cold War, where you were trying to persuade people that communism was harmful and aggressive and imperialistic, and free systems provided opportunities for people.
And so the question remains then, Don, how do we better communicate that to the American people? I mean, on some sort of intellectual level, we know that. But at the time of 9/11, we came up with the idea of weapons of mass destruction. And that's how we sort of sold the idea of going into Iraq, searching for those weapons of mass destruction. In retrospect, how could we have played that better?
Well, in the first place, the policy of the United States from the 90s was regime change in Iraq. And the Congress, Republicans and Democrats, passed a regime change resolution, and President Clinton signed it. There were 17 UN resolutions asking Iraq to allow inspectors to determine the extent to which Iraq had or had not dismantled its weapons of mass destruction programs. We knew Iraq had used weapons of mass destruction, chemical weapons, against the Iranians and against their own people.
Their own people, yes.
The Kurds and the Shia. But we didn't know precisely about stockpiles, if you will. It turned out when the major combat operation was over, the inspectors did go in, and they determined that they could not find stockpiles. However, they did find the people who did it working together there. They found the precursors that were needed to rapidly increase their stockpiles, and they found the intent that Saddam Hussein had to develop those weapons in quick notice. Indeed, Delfer's report said in a matter of weeks they could do it. Now, you say, how could you have done it better? I think what might have been done better would have been to not hang it on stockpiles, but hang it on the capability to develop those weapons in a country that had already used them.
All right. All right, we're talking to Donald Rumsfeld, everybody, who is a New York Times best-selling author, of course, former Secretary of Defense, about his memoir, Known and Unknown. Don, I want to change gears and get a little more contemporary, if I can, with you, because Robert Gates, who is the 22nd Secretary of Defense of the United States, said in front of the Corps of Cadets at West Point, and I'm quoting now, "In my opinion, any future defense secretary who advises the president to again send a big American land army into Asia or the Middle East or Africa should have his head examined," as General MacArthur so delicately put it. What would your comments be to Secretary Gates's comments?
Oh, I think he's right. I think that clearly our capabilities are appropriate for armies, navies, and air forces, and for special forces tasks. And to send a major force into any one of those continents, it seems to me, is a mistake. Would be a mistake prospectively, because it would imply not that you were going up against major armies or navies or air forces. What you'd be doing is going up against a terrorist network or some very modest military capability, but you would be engaged in the first instance in an asymmetric war as opposed to a conventional conflict, and that's not really the best. You don't need a major military force to do that. And third, it could imply that you were engaging in nation building, which I think is really not something the Department of Defense should or can do in any major way over any sustained period of time.
Okay, let me ask you to go back to when then President-elect George W. Bush asked you to return to as Secretary of Defense, and you did accept that position, I'm sure after much consideration. But one of your goals was to transform the military. At that time, what were your goals for transforming the military?
Well, President Bush had laid them out in a speech at the Citadel, and when he asked me to take that assignment, I agreed to, and it was to begin and carry on the process of transforming the Department of Defense and bringing it into the 21st century. We made terrific progress. We repositioned our forces around the world. They were pretty much where they were left over from the Cold War. Second, we dramatically increased our special forces and improved their equipment and their numbers and their authorities, and we're able today to do the kinds of things we're doing because of those significant increases. Third, we dramatically increased the number of unmanned aerial vehicles, which, of course, are so valuable to us today in terms of tracking and monitoring and intelligence gathering and attacking without risking U.S. military personnel. And most important, we moved from the historic division army units down to brigade combat teams, which are highly capable, smaller, and highly mobile and lethal, and capable of enabling us to do the kinds of things we're doing today. And if there are many other things that were done as well, but those four things, it seems to me, are terribly important examples of the kinds of transformation that President Bush wanted.
All right, we're talking to Donald Rumsfeld, everybody. His latest book, a memoir, Known and Unknown. And Don, I want you to go back to September 11th of 2001 and describe for my listeners your personal experience on that day.
Well, it was a terrible day for our country to see the aircraft collapse, the two World Trade Center towers, and then to feel the Pentagon shake as I was getting my morning intelligence briefing, and then to rush outside and see the bodies being pulled out of the building and the burning and the smoke, and recognize that this terrorist network had attacked the seat of our economic power in New York and the seat of our military power in the Pentagon. And except for the heroism of the passengers in the third aircraft that was forced down in Pennsylvania, there's no question but that they would have attacked the seat of our political power, either the Capitol building or the White House, one or the other.
Hmm.
And it was heartbreaking to see it. I determined that we'd keep the Pentagon open despite the fact that the place was still burning and they were still taking bodies out, but we did keep it open and were able to clear enough of the smoke and portions of the building that we could still function and not give the terrorists the feeling that they were able to shut us down.
Well, Don, looking back over your political career, which has truly spanned about 50 years, I'd like to go back to the beginning in politics, because most people don't realize how long you've been serving the country and in what capacities in politics. So let's go back to your first position, which was getting elected to Congress at the age of 29. So how did you, as a middle-class kid from Chicago, first of all, get elected to Congress at age 29? Why were you so dissatisfied with, at that point, the GOP leadership in the House in the 1960s that it motivated you to run?
Well, I'd been a Navy pilot, and then I'd worked in Washington in the House of Representatives during the Eisenhower period. And I went home, and the incumbent congressman from that district announced she wasn't going to run for re-election. And she and her husband had been in that district for most of my lifetime, over 30 years. And I decided that if I didn't run, then I might never have a chance. And so I jumped into it at age 29, and you know, it's amazing to think about it. I was described by a person writing a PhD dissertation as distinguished principally by my total lack of social, financial, and political standing in the community.
Ouch.
I read that to my wife, and she said, "Don, go back to sleep. It's tough to argue with."
Oh, it's good to have support at home, isn't it, Don?
Yes, indeed. But I ran, and thanks to a lot of friends from high school and college, where I'd gone to college on a scholarship, I was able to win. And I got down there, and there were a lot of Republicans who'd been in the minority for years, and they seemed comfortable in the minority. And I wasn't comfortable. I thought the purpose of running for office was to try to have the majority and be able to implement your legislative plans. And so I went to work for Gerald Ford, helping him get elected first conference chairman of the Republican Party and then minority leader of the party.
Well, and then after your stint in Congress, you actually left Congress to join the Nixon administration, and again, putting you at the apex of what turns out to be American history. So first of all, why did you take the job with the Nixon administration? Because as you describe it, it's a job that couldn't be done.
I did. I first took on a domestic agency that had been Lyndon Johnson's War on Poverty, and tried to help straighten that out, which I did, I think. And then I took on an economic stabilization job for President Nixon. And then I went off and was U.S. ambassador to NATO and was over there when Richard Nixon had to resign. And Gerald Ford, the vice president, became the first president in history who'd never run for president or vice president. And, of course, he'd been a friend from Congress. And he called me back to chair his transition and then later to become his chief of staff and still later to become Secretary of Defense under the Ford administration.
Well, now, don't downplay it, because that was one of the bleakest times in American history, as I said at the outset. And you were there truly in the middle of it as we made an historic transition of power that most countries could not have accomplished. So as an insider during that particular moment of history, what stand out as some of the really most memorable things in that transition?
Well, you're quite right. It was a terribly difficult time, and without question, being chief of staff of the White House in that administration was the toughest job I ever had. But what stands out is that the reservoir of trust had been drained in the country, and thanks to the basic human decency and naturalness of Gerald R. Ford, the country recovered and was healed. And the difficult thing was we had a person who was a wonderful human being, and his natural inclination was towards continuity and reassurance. And he had been a legislator, not an executive. So it took him a period to become comfortable as an executive. And he made a series of decisions, and he brought the country forward and refilled that reservoir of trust.
Ah, well put. We're talking to Donald Rumsfeld, everybody, author of the memoir Known and Unknown. And Don, you're coming out here to Ventura County. You're going to be speaking at the Ronald Reagan Presidential Library in Simi Valley. You're also going to be doing a book signing there. Tell me a little bit about the proceeds from the sale of your book. I know that the proceeds go to the Rumsfeld Foundation. Expand on that a little bit for my listeners so they know where that money is going.
You bet. Joyce and I have so much respect for the young men and women who serve in the armed forces and for their families who also serve. And anyone involved in a war knows that people are killed and people are wounded. And when we visited the troops in the hospitals, as we often did, we'd always come out inspired by them and by their families and by their pride in what they're doing, their understanding of why what they're doing was so important. And what we've decided to do is our foundation gives to a number of charities that support the troops, such as Paws for Patriots that provide guide dogs for those that need them, the Rivers of Recovery that assist people, Wounded Warrior Project, the Fisher House. And we've decided that all of our proceeds from the book would be given to the troops and their families and to the children of those who've fallen because of our enormous respect for them.
Well, very, very admirable. Folks, we've been talking to Donald Rumsfeld, former Secretary of Defense, also now author, New York Times bestselling author of the memoir Known and Unknown. Don, if people want to learn more about you, learn more about your book, or about your foundation, where would you direct them to go on the Internet?
Well, they can go to rumsfeld.com, and what we've done is created a website where I think for the first time we have taken something like 2,500 primary source documents that I've used in the book in many instances. So people can read the book, Known and Unknown, look at an endnote, and see where I've quoted a paragraph from a memo. They can then go right to the website and read the entire memo and see the context. My hope is that people will be interested seriously in public service and in history and go there and actually understand the complexity, as you pointed out, of these decisions, the fact that they are multidimensional. And at that level, they're almost always made with incomplete and even imperfect information. And I think that by looking at the memos in the website, people will be able to see that and come away with a better understanding of how government works.
That's great. We've been talking to Donald Rumsfeld, former Secretary of Defense, also author of the memoir Known and Unknown. Don, thank you so much for being our special guest here on Brainstorming. We'll talk to you down the road.
I look forward to it. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Don.